good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for joining us tonight. We had a situation here you might be interested in. The Pardons and Parole Board here in Georgia, about 2 hours ago, spared a convicted killer from execution shortly before he was due to die by lethal injection and commuted his sentence to life in prison. The Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, this is from Reuters News Agency, made its decision less than 3 hours before Samuel David Crow, 47, was to be executed. According to a spokeswoman for the state's prisons, the parole board said, quote, after careful and exhaustive consideration of the requests, the board voted to grant clemency. The board voted to commute the sentence to life without parole, end quote. Crow was not present at the board hearing in Atlanta. He had eaten his last meal and was preparing to enter the execution chamber at the prison in Jackson, Georgia. In March 1988, Samuel Crow killed a store manager of Indian descent named Pela during a robbery in Douglas County, just west of Atlanta. Crow, who had previously worked at the store, shot Pela 3 times with a pistol, beat him almost into an unrecognizable pulp with a crowbar and a pot of paint. The following year, Crow pled guilty to armed robbery and murder and was sentenced to death. According to Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, an advocacy group that welcomed the board's decision, quote, David Crow takes full responsibility for his crime and experiences profound remorse, end quote. At today's hearing, his lawyers presented a dossier of evidence attesting to his remorse and good behavior in jail, according to local media reports. The lawyer also said that David Crow was suffering from withdrawal symptoms from a cocaine addiction at the time of the murder. Blah, 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 blah. Now, yesterday I was talking about this, and I'll have more to say about the execution of Troy Davis later on the program, but I was quoting from statistics that when the murder victim is non-white, the chances of the convicted killer, no matter the race of the killer, the chances of that killer being executed are way, way, way less than if the murder victim is white. If the murder victim is Caucasian, again, regardless of the race of the killer, that person has a far greater chance of being executed for the crime. Last night, Troy Davis, was a black man, was executed for the murder of off-duty Savannah police officer who was white. Today, a white man who confessed to the murder and the murder was particularly violent and vicious. This was one of the close contact murders where someone is methodically beaten to death. And in this case, almost the corpse was almost beyond recognition. The Douglas County Sheriff, who investigated this all those years ago, said he had, at that point, never seen a crime scene where there was more blood and gore than he saw at that crime scene. However, the victim, in the case that was a death penalty, the case was commuted today to life without parole, the victim was non-white, and the confessed convicted killer was white. There's plenty of evidence in addition to the confession There was as much DNA evidence as anyone could possibly want, as much forensic evidence as anyone could possibly want. It was a singularly brutal, violent murder. But the man convicted of that murder, Samuel David Crowe, had his death sentence commuted today to life without parole because he took responsibility for his crime. He experiences profound remorse and has had good behavior in jail for the past 23 years. Oh, and he was suffering from cocaine addiction at the time of the crime. Now, the story really doesn't say anything except the arbitrariness, the capriciousness with which the death penalty is used. Executions. So, you know, if you are against capital punishment, you are against capital punishment. The case in Texas prior to the execution here in Georgia last night, Troy Davis was in Texas, the white man who had dragged the black man behind his pickup truck to the point that when the sheriff found that one, they thought it was the corpse of the victim. They thought it was roadkill. It was so horrific. That man was executed last night. And I was listening to Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC a few moments ago. Lawrence O'Donnell said about the only one protesting the Texas white man, racist psychopath, that's how he was identified, his execution was Dick Gregory, because Gregory is anti-capital punishment, period. It doesn't make any difference of the abhorrent nature of the crime or how violent it was. You are either, because if you don't, and the point Lawrence O'Donnell is trying to make, if you don't protest also the murder, if you don't protest the pending execution of the white man in Texas who did what he did, and do protest the pending execution of the black man in Atlanta or in Georgia who did what he did, then you are pretty much declaring that you are not really against the death penalty. You are against the death penalty in certain circumstances. It's a real conundrum, isn't it? Huh? Isn't that a problem? That's a real problem. But I thought you'd like to know that the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles commuted the death sentence of a white man a couple hours ago. The white man was scheduled to be dead just about now for a massively horrific murder that he perpetrated against a non-Caucasian just east or west of Atlanta 23 years ago. So, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, they can commute death sentences when they really feel like it. You know, they can do that. And the white man here in Georgia was remorseful. Plus, he had a nice record, good behavior for the past 23 years in prison. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I've seen them fight like lions, boys. I've seen them go like lambs. And I've helped to drag them when they could not stand. And I've heard their mamas crying when they heard that big door slam. And I've seen the victim's family holding hands. Last night I dreamed that I woke up with straps across my chest, and something cold and black pumped through my lungs. Even Jesus couldn't save me, though I know he did his best. But he don't live on.
Each time you listen to Right Wing Radio, God kills a kitten.
21 past the hour. And by the way, the story I just shared with you, the white guy who was spared execution, actually it was datelined 3 years ago, which doesn't change the story one bit, except 3 years ago, the state of Georgia, the Board of Pardons and Paroles, was willing to spare the life of a man who had committed a horrendous murder and confessed to it. And last night, a man who insisted on his innocence was put to death when the evidence did not support an execution. Either a society is going to have a death penalty or it isn't. And what we have in this country is a death penalty that is selective, highly capricious. Depending on the kind of jury that you get, if you're a defense attorney or a prosecuting attorney, and as you know, in some murder cases, the death penalty isn't even sought because the prosecution may feel that a conviction would escape them if the death penalty was asked for in the verdict. So they go for life or life without parole. So the point of all of it is, of course, that aside from the barbarity of consigning people to execution by the state when they have committed, granted, horrific crimes. But because there is such a disparity in how these cases are even brought to trial, much less how they are, how a sentence is passed, or, I'm sorry, how a verdict is rendered and sentence is passed, and whether or not that sentence is carried out. That's the point. Rick Perry's, you know, the Republicans are down in Florida with another one of those debates, if you want to call them that. And Rick Perry, I'm sure, is there. I can't watch this garbage anymore. But earlier this week, according to Mother Jones, earlier this week, when Texas Governor Rick Perry announced his leadership team for the Presidency 5 straw poll in Florida. I don't know what that means either. That's scheduled for October. All the other major candidates have decided to skip the event, but Perry is hoping for a strong showing there will give him a boost, a straw poll that nobody really gives a damn about. So what's his strategy for voter outreach? Well, according to Mojo, it looks a lot like The Response. That was the prayer festival he organized in August at a football stadium in Houston. Take, for instance, his new co-chair in Florida. Her name is Pam Olson. She is the founder of the Tallahassee House of Prayer, a leading anti-abortion activist in the state. And as Right Wing Watch notes, Ms. Olson also believes that gay marriage and its increasing acceptance among American Christians is causing tornadoes and stuff. Gay marriage. Here's what she said in July, quote, "God is shaking. If anybody looks at the news and has just seen what's been happening recently with the floods, the fires, the tornadoes, God is shaking. Yes, I think you have God shaking. Sure you have. The enemy shaking. You have both, and I don't want to say, oh, that's the judgment of God or that's the enemy, but the reality is God shaking. He's judging us, and I think it's going to get worse." And she went on to screech about gay marriage is causing tornadoes and earthquakes. Jesus, God. Yes, yes, yes. This is your Republican Party. Oh, my God. As Mojo says, it's somewhat unclear why Texas, whose governor supports criminalizing gay sex, would be punished with raging wildfires for having too high a tolerance for gay rights. I mean, not in Texas. There's no such thing in Texas. But Miss Pam, the prayer lady, Her view is wholly consistent with Perry's other allies on the religious right. And if you'll remember, the response, that prayer and, I don't know, festival or whatever the hell it was, featured a number of pastors who believed that, among other things, 9/11 was God's way of punishing America for tolerating gay folk. And the blackbirds that died suddenly in Arkansas last winter were a harbinger of the end times. And, you know, sure, of course. The Republican Party, I've been saying this for 5 years, 10 years, the Republican Party is filled with people who are psychotic. They are clinically insane, and the area of insanity has to do with mass psychosis. Duh. At TVNewsLies.org, two North Carolina men were exonerated in North Carolina today after a decade behind bars for murder. They were exonerated today after a panel of judges in North Carolina ruled they were innocent. The three-judge panel made its decision after hearing 7 days of testimony about the case against a 31-year-old and his 32-year-old co-defendant. The hearing came after the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Yeah, they have one there. It's a state, North Carolina, Innocence Inquiry Commission. Found, no, we don't have that here in Georgia, or Texas, or most of the cities that there, most of the states, the old Confederacy, for damn sure. Anyway, this North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission found enough evidence to indicate the men were innocent. That evidence included the confession of another man and DNA testing that points to other suspects. The men had pled guilty to second-degree murder in 2000, though they repeatedly claimed they were innocent. Their attorney at the hearing said they admitted to the murder to avoid life sentences. That's usually what, you know, what the prosecutor would say. We're going to fry your ass, boy. We're going to lock you up for the rest of your life unless you plead guilty. North Carolina is among a growing number of states taking steps to prevent and address wrongful convictions and grant greater access to biological evidence. It has the nation's only investigative innocence commission, North Carolina. And either Jesse or Reg over at TV News Live put a comment with it. How many others have been forced to confess to crimes they didn't commit? DNA testing does not take 10 years. It takes money. That's right. That's exactly what it takes. Prairie 2 says Rule 48 is in effect. This is not a drill. You ready? The Dow fell 400 points today, even after New York Stock Exchange executed a rule designed to keep down the panic. The exchange invoked Rule 48, which limits how much information is released about stock trades by the designated market makers. In other words, the big guys will trade behind closed doors and you can just guess what's really happening. How this is supposed to calm the markets, I'm not sure. Maybe what the suckers don't know won't hurt them. The U.S. did do better than the 5% or more drop on the European markets. Asia wasn't as bad Thursday, But they are day ahead, so we'll see how that's going in late evening here as the sun rises in Japan. China says things are weak in manufacturing, and China has been the one ray of hope the rest of the new flat earth was clinging to. FedEx has drastically cut its earning forecast as people aren't buying electronics and toys from China. The Volatility Investor Index, also known as the Fear Index, which measures the average investor's feeling of panic, rose 17% today to 43.7, well above the normal. The what? The Fear Index? Jesus Christ. Capitalism is a hoot, isn't it? The market falling was metaphor for the subject of President Obama's speech today, or maybe the other way around. The president stood in front of an aging bridge that connects Ohio and Kentucky. As he put it to Republicans, quote, help us put this country back to work, pass this jobs bill right away, end quote. Republicans called his appearance in front of the crumbling, overcrowded, obsolete, but vital highway link a stunt. Yeah, right. You know, it's not really crumbling. It's just a stunt. Speaker Boehner was unable to pass a continuing budget resolution as the teabaggers rejected it, supposedly because of a billion-dollar amendment that Eric Cantor had slipped in the budget to pay for earthquake damage in his district. If Congress can't pass a bill before they leave on Yom Kippur break, which is, what, Friday, then the federal government will grind to a halt on October 1. Speaker Boehner is threatening to make the normally three-day-a-week Republicans stay through the weekend. Uh-oh. All commodities, including gold, were down sharply today. The only things selling well were the U.S. dollars and U.S. Treasury notes. As their price goes up, of course, interest yield on bonds goes down. The three-month T-bill is yielding 0.0102%. That's 1%. Or 1/100th of one. Oh, my God. And the 10-year note is at 1.71% in trading today. The 10-year note is 1%, 1.71%. Jesus, never mind. If you bought them back in January and sold them today, you made a tidy profit. The Dow will need to drop another 485 points to qualify as a new bear market. That would be a 20% drop since the last high. There's your definition. Friday has started by now in Asia. We'll see how it goes. Pray too. You know, I just have stopped paying attention to the fluctuations in the market, in the Dow Jones in industrials. I really have. It's somebody else's game. Does it affect the economy here? No, it's more of a reflection than a, it's more of an effect than a cause. I think, if I'm wrong on that, I'm sure Bruce will correct me, but, to my way of thinking, Prairie to himself has told me that most, institutional, I think he said this, most institutional investors have pretty much pulled out because of the volatility and the fact that it's plunging. So who's left? The big boys that now get to trade, you know, Rule 48, they get to go behind closed doors and manipulate each other as much as they want to. Ooh, that sounds a little obscene, doesn't it? Here, let me manipulate you and you manipulate me. Capitalism is just so much fun. Joe Walsh, you remember him? Yesterday, he was named among Congress's 13 most corrupt representatives. Oh, he's awful. This guy's awful. This is a guy who is, he's got thousands upon thousands of dollars of unpaid child support. And he went on a radio program, or is it television? I don't know. With Brent Bozell, Media Research Center's Brent Bozell, to discuss the mainstream media's protection of Obama. And Walsh said that the reason he's getting protected is because he's a black man. Oh, my God. Walsh said, quote, this guy, that would be the president of the United States, this guy pushed every one of the media's buttons. He was liberal, He was different. He was new. He was black. Oh, my God. It was the potpourri of everything. They're so vested in our first black president not being a failure that it's going to be amazing to watch the lengths they go to protect him. The media, I believe, will spout this racist line if some of his colleagues up here aren't doing it aggressively enough. This is going to be a real desperation, end quote. I don't know what this sick bastard's talking about. He goes on. He says, why was he elected? Again, it comes back to who he was. He was black. He was historic. And there's nothing racist about this, about what I'm saying. It is what it is. If he had been a dynamic white state senator elected to Congress, he wouldn't have gotten in the game this fast. This is what made him different. Let me see. Wasn't John Kennedy? Oh, never mind. That combined with the fact that your profession, not you, but your profession, you know, journalism, was just absolutely compliant. They made up their minds early that they were in love with him. They were in love with him because they thought he was a good liberal guy, and they were loving him because he pushed the magic button, a black man who was articulate. Oh, Jesus, God in heaven. Now, Joe Walsh is... He was named by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington crew as among Congress's 13 most corrupt representatives. And there are 435 members of Congress, members of the House. The report says that this freshman Tea Party jerk, his ethics issues stem from his failure to pay child support and accurately disclose income and liabilities on his personal financial disclosure forms, and his campaign committee's inaccurate reporting of interest payments on his loans to his campaigns. Walsh is accused of owing more than $100,000 in back child support to his ex-wife, child support. In his ex-wife's filing last December, she claimed that Walsh said he could not afford to make the payments for their three children. Well, at the time, he loaned his own campaign $35,000 and took vacations abroad. Now, the child support allegations are not the only questions regarding Walsh. While he was campaigning last year, former campaign field director Richard Cape claimed he would spend uncontrollably. His former campaign manager eventually sued for $20,000 in non-payment. It just goes on and on and on and on. And yet, this freak, Republican from Illinois, I'll bet the folks back home just love him, huh? Don't you sick bastards who put him in office, don't you just love somebody who refuses to pay child support? Huh? Isn't that nice? Another typical Republican.
Seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Coming up next hour, we have from our education affairs correspondent a report card that is very timely given the discussion is going on about executions. Ron Paul, he wasn't joking about letting uninsured people die. Did you hear about this? It's a sad story, and it more or less proves that when Ron Paul was talking about people having the freedom to, you know, choose not to buy health insurance and or to be insured, and if they then find themselves in a terrible state, well, and the audience, of course, filled in the rest for him, let him die. And, of course, Paul didn't dispute that. But as it turns out, Ron Paul where does this come from, Kathy? Do you know? I don't either. It turns out Ron Paul was not speaking purely in hypotheticals. Back in 2008, Kent Snyder, Paul's former campaign chairman, died of complications from pneumonia. And like the man in Blitzer's example, Wolf Blitzer's example, the 49-year-old Snyder, Ron Paul's former campaign chairman, was relatively young and seemingly healthy when the illness struck. He was also uninsured. The Kansas City Star quoted his sister at the time of his death as saying that, quote, a pre-existing condition made the premiums too expensive. And when he died, 2 weeks after Ron Paul withdrew his first bid for the presidency, the hospital costs had accumulated and amounted to $400,000. That bill was handed to Kent Snyder's surviving mother, who was incapable of paying, and friends launched a website to solicit donations. Somehow, Ron Paul managed to turn Kent Snyder's death into an opportunity to spout off about freedom. You know, the freedom we have to die and leave our families with massive piles of debt. Anyway, after Kent Snyder died, Ron Paul's former campaign chairman, Ron Paul posted a message at the website, his Campaign for Liberty, Liberty website, a pre-Tea Party organization which served as Ron Paul's financial marketing tool and platform to promote his crazy free market ideas. And this is what Ron Paul wrote. Like so many in our movement, Kent sacrificed much for the cause of liberty. Kent poured every ounce of his being into our fight for freedom. He will always hold a place in my heart and in the hearts of my family. End quote. And as I mentioned the other night, National Nurses United, the co-chair of that organization we had on the program last night, but as I mentioned earlier in the week, they issued a statement saying National Nurses United said the gruesome reaction from many in the audience is a reminder of the growing collapse of civil society in America and the need for more humane policies. One such step would be expand Medicare to cover all Americans so that no one has to be in danger of dying because they're uninsured. And remember, I read the whole thing for you. And it was... what was the number? Something like 35,000 people a year die in this country because they don't have health insurance. You know, would survive if they had it. Oh, well. Oh, and the audience cheers came, and I mentioned this to you also, if you remember. The cheers came just hours before the release last Tuesday of the new Census Bureau data showing the number of uninsured Americans this year rising by another 1 million. We are now at 50 million uninsured in this country, one out of six people. This is really turning into a goddamn sick place to live, isn't it, Kathy? I mean, how are we going to raise our child in this? I mean, how does anybody, really, what do you tell your kids? What did I read today? That demographic, what is it, 21 to 35 or something? All the people, millions of people in that age group are forced to move back home because they can't, there's no work. Marriages are being put on hold. Child bearing is being put on hold. There are no careers. People with undergraduate degrees. It's now the Republicans have been very successful. They always blame Obama, and for the first time, more than 50% of Americans are getting to the point where they really blame Obama for the nation's economic woes. I blame him for not taking decisive action to end this madness, this economic madness, which, in my opinion, he could do. But I think that's a little bit different from blaming him, laying the cause of the stuff on him. That was the Bush crime family. That was every Republican policy. You know, Eric Cantor talks about, well, we're not going to allow money go for flood relief or hurricane relief or tornado relief unless we have offsets someplace else. These rancid son of a bitch and right wingers, they never said anything about that where it concerned the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? They never said anything about offsets when they cut the taxes for the wealthy, right? Huh? Where do you think you live, Truth Seeker? All right, stick around. We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. Report here from John in Fargo about what's going on at the Republican circle jerk down in Florida. Greetings, Mike. Wow, I have to say, watching this Republican debate, as much as they hate the government, I don't know why the hell they're running for and have been in this big government takeover of our lives in the name of killing freedom. They are for abolishing the Department of Education, the EPA. Just have vouchers for schools if people want to go to public, private, or homeschooling. I guess we no longer need to have a standardized education level. This just leaves no money for public schools. The rich and well-to-do will only be able to afford the private schools. Are there this many insane people? They clap for anti-Obama statements, clap for executions by the state, clap for stepping on people at public rallies, cheering for the death of the uninsured, for the socialist health care Obama has made a stake, spitting at congressmen, constant lies, mistruths, half-truths, hate and warmongers, bombing family health care clinics, anti-immigrants. Where does one stop? Where does it end, Mike? I just cannot believe this country I live in. Freedom has become just a voice stamp that should just be copyrighted by the Republican con jobbers. No. There's more here. I ramble, but there's so much I could go on for days on end. They have enough material for 100 years of comedy satire and a fabric plant all rolled into one. Thanks, Mike, for years of keeping me sane, blah, blah, blah. John in Fargo. All right, John, thanks. I know it's, that'll make you crazy if you watch that stuff. It really will. Oh, and, Bruce Enberg, Prairie 2, sent me a quickie here about the market. Who's in and who's out? I said the institutional, investors are gone. See, you should open your mouth, Mike, when you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Prairie 2 says the retail investors, people with their own money, at least the smart ones, they're the ones that fled early in the year. The institutional investors, people betting with other people's money, are still there. If your 401k plan says to invest in stock, in the stock market, that's what they're obliged to do. And then you have hedge funds trying to time the market or manipulate it. Also the big banks who do high speed trading. Then there are the dark markets, quote, quote, also run by the banks, where more than half of the trading is done completely in secret. All of this is done to harvest the money that has been put into the market by 401ks and pension funds over the last 30 years. Now, at some point, it will simply be gone. That's what's called, quote, the bottom of the market, end quote. Using past precedent, this should happen at about, when the Dow hits about 1,500. The market can't, in theory, go to zero, as stocks do pay dividends again at some point. Of course, we could have a spate of Chapter 11 reorganizations if things get bad enough. This typically wipes out the stockholders, but somehow the fat cats just get fatter, probably because they can borrow money at nearly zero interest and buy up the distressed companies. Isn't capitalism wonderful? Well, if you are one, I guess it's great fun. Do we have, Kathy, do you know where the, do you have handy the educational, our education correspondence, education affairs correspondent, the music? Let's see if we can do this right. And it's been a while since we had a report card from Kay. You can read all her stuff at kaysreportcard.com, K-A-Y-S, reportcard.com. Oh, there it is. 'Cause their father's hell. From Kay Petrini, a school teacher in San Francisco who is our education affairs correspondent, she writes, "Hi, Mike. Back in my college Republican days, I know, mea culpa. I was adamantly pro-death penalty. I was young, and back then, the theories put forth by the Republican Party sounded attractive, e.g., America is a meritocracy, people who are unemployed just need to get off their asses and find a job, and those convicted of violent crimes are certainly guilty." This was during the mid-1980s, just a short time after the voters of California turned out the much maligned California State Supreme Court Chief Justice Rose Byrd. The reason for her removal? Well, here's what Wikipedia says. Byrd was removed in the November 4th, 1986 election by a margin of 67% to 33% after a high-profile campaign that cited her categorical opposition to the death penalty. She received a total of 64 capital cases appealed to the court. In each instance, she issued a decision overturning the death penalty that had been imposed at trial. This led Byrd's critics to claim that she was substituting her own opinions and ideas for the laws and precedents upon which judicial decisions are supposed to be made. End quote. Wikipedia. Kay goes on, Rose Byrd's anti-death penalty tenure on the court spanned the years from 1978 to 1986. Prior to that, there had not been an execution in the state of California since 1967, when I was 2 years old and obviously far too young to be conscious of that event. Fast forward to 1992 and the execution of Robert Elton Harris in San Quentin's gas chamber. I was in my late 20s then, and this was the first time I had experienced what seemed like a hometown execution, San Quentin being just across the Golden Gate Bridge from the city. I remember being transfixed on the news that night, and I remember a reporter cheerily describing the scene he had witnessed from his perch in the gallery. After I turned off the news at about 11:30 p.m., I couldn't sleep. When I finally did fall asleep, I had nightmares. The combination of insomnia and terrifying dreams went on for about 10 days and taught me a valuable lesson. In fact, Mr. Harris's execution is what radically changed my views on the death penalty. It was not until then that I understood the barbarity of the practice and realized that this was being done in my name by my government. Sad to say, it took an execution taking place, quote, in my own backyard, end quote, to finally wake me up. During the last school year, we spent quite during this past school year, we spent quite a bit of time discussing the death penalty as a community. The entire student body, faculty, and staff read the book Dead Man Walking by Sister Helen Prejean. Our theater teacher received special permission from the actor Tim Robbins to produce his Dead Man Walking play about Sister Helen's experiences with an all-female cast, because we are an all-girls school. Our students were incredible, particularly the actress who played the role of the convicted killer. Sister Helen visited our school twice, once to attend the play and address the student body, and a few months later with the actress Susan Sarandon, who had played the role of Sister Helen in the film version of Dead Man Walking, in tow. Throughout the year, teachers in all fields of study incorporated Dead Man Walking-based lessons into their curricula. For example, chemistry students learned about the drug compounds that are used in lethal injections. Math students researched death penalty statistics. My history students learned about the murder of a former student at our school and watched video clips in which her parents described their pain over the horrific crime that took their daughter's life back in 1979. To sum it up, we examined the issue from the perspective of the perpetrators and the victims, and we left it to the students to think about the issue deeply. That is why today it was heartening to hear students talking about the impact of Troy Davis's execution on his family, the family of the victim, and on them. It was clear that they had internalized this debate, which we struggled with as a school community last year. It made me realize that for my students, unlike me, this issue will never merely be a matter of theory. The reaction of Dead Man Walking, their reading of Dead Man Walking, their participation in related lessons across the curriculum, and their interactions with Sister Helen Prejean ensured that to them the issue is real. And based on the discussions I heard among students today, it's clear that they understand the problem of violence in this society. Even more importantly, they're very skeptical about claims that institutionalized violence will solve it. K.
Past the hour.
You can read Kay's report cards at her website, Kay's, K-A-Y-S, reportcard.com, kaysreportcard.com. You may find this interesting. From freewoodpost.com. From our friend Mark in Manhattan. Mike, you may have seen this already, but here are some shocking things Fox News viewers believe. For years, the left wing has been saying that Fox News viewers are uneducated or misinformed, but now a study has come out that might confirm those suspicions. According to a new survey of Fox News viewers by Reuters news agency, this is what Fox News viewers believe. 67% believe Barack Obama's name sounds suspicious. 45% believe that homosexuals are polygamists. 2% believe that science is more important than faith. 2%. 90% believe that all of the founding fathers were born in the United States of America, even though the United States of America had not yet been created when the founding fathers were born. Oh my God. These are things Fox viewers believe. 56% believe Sarah Palin went to an Ivy League law school. 99% of Fox News viewers who were Medicare recipients said they opposed socialized medicine. 94% believe that Reagan lowered the national debt. 15% believe that George Washington defeated the King of England in a duel for America. 88% believe that Bill Clinton failed as a president because of his affair with Monica Lewinsky. 75% believe that people on welfare are lazy. 24% believe Santa Claus is real. 36% believe the Bill of Rights is actually legislation introduced by the Republican Party to stop, quote, Barack Obama's socialist agenda, end quote. 99% believe that communism, socialism, fascism, and tyranny are all the same. 70% believe that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. 38% believe Barack Obama was born in Indonesia. Why does that equal 100? Because some people can't tell the difference between Kenya and Indonesia. 85% don't think Hawaii was even a state when Barack Obama was born. 76% believe Sarah Palin has, quote, an Alaskan accent. 92% believe that Bill Clinton left Barack Obama with a surplus, which he, Obama, spent. 96% believe the economy was doing great when Barack Obama took office. 84% believe the Tea Party is a grassroots movement without any corporate sponsorship. 94% believe the Constitution mentions Jesus Christ as America's savior. 23% believe FEMA is building concentration camps. 63% believe Glenn Beck is a healthy weight. 37% believe Nancy Pelosi is a witch and that she can cast spells. 25% believe Anthony Weiner's resignation was good for the economy. 92% couldn't find Iraq on a map. 9% believe that homosexuals are trying to take over America with glitter. 93% could not name the continents. 12% believe that John Quincy Adams was a founding father. 99% believe that the government doesn't create jobs. But 95% of those surveyed credit Governor Rick Perry of creating 1 million jobs as governor of Texas. While some of these might seem comical, the most shocking result from the study was this. 100% of Fox News viewers said they wouldn't care if the entire country fell apart as long as Barack Obama isn't elected to a second term. From Mark in Manhattan. Thanks, Mark. Is that real? Is that from Reuters or is that from The Onion? I believe it. I mean, I have never met a dumber clutch of freaks than Fox News viewers. I swear. There is just no other collection of human beings in America that constitute as much ignorance, bigotry, and stupidity as people who watch Fox. We'll be back.
Think about what you're trying to do to me, yeah. Think that you might go like yourself.
is your nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Have you been to OccupyWallStreet.org? You should check it out. The protests going on there. This really got me. A reporter from Channel 5 in Cleveland, a reporter named Ellen McGregor. I don't know. I have a feeling she got all freaked out here. She has a report. It says, for 6 days, varying numbers of protesters have camped out in New York's old Liberty Plaza. Now there's a message about Cleveland on the protests' website. Here's what it says. Quote, oh, the message comes from Anonymous. And according to Ellen, it's a self-described leaderless group behind Occupy Wall Street. This is what the message is on the website. Quote, we stood in solidarity with Madrid, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Madison, Toronto, London, Athens, Sydney, Stuttgart, Tokyo, Milan, Amsterdam, Algiers, Tel Aviv, Portland, and Chicago. Soon we will stand with Phoenix, Montreal, Cleveland, and Atlanta. We're still here. We are growing. We intend to stay until we see movements toward real change in our country and the world. End quote. Now, what got Ms. McGregor upset? Apparently, it mentions Cleveland in what it calls a, quote, communique from Anonymous, end quote, about what the, quote, U.S. Day of Vengeance, end quote, on Saturday, what it will mean to Cleveland. Oh, no. So, Ms. McGregor with Newsnet5.com called Cleveland's law department to see if any permits had been filed for any demonstrations or protests in Cleveland on Saturday. And when this was posted, Ms. Ellen McGregor was still waiting for a call back. Now, this is for real, you know. Okay, this is the stuff about Fox News viewers. I was just kind of pulling on your pant leg there a little bit. But this is for real. She's waiting for a callback with the information. Earlier this week, the Occupy Wall Street website also claimed a similar demonstration was in the planning stages for Los Angeles. So far, that has not materialized. Ms. McGregor, this is called... It's a diversionary tactic. It's called get the local news media to do some free publicity for you. Anyway, Ms. McGregor goes on to say demonstrations have been mostly peaceful, blah, 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 blah. Protesters say they refuse to let the gatherings become violent, blah, 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 blah. Participants say they will stay until the one demand, quote, quote, one demand is met. But Ms. McGregor writes, but it's not clear what that one demand is. All right, well, maybe I can help you, Ms. McGregor, what the one demand is. This is from, this is the fifth communique issued by OccupyWallStreet.org from the 99%. This is the one demand, Ellen. Ms. McGregor, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be familiar with you. Ms. McGregor, this is the one demand. On September 21st, 2001, I'm sorry, 2011, Troy Davis, an innocent man, was murdered by the state of Georgia. Troy Davis was one of the 99%. Ending capital punishment is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, the richest 400 Americans owned more wealth than half the country's population. Ending wealth inequality is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, four of our members were arrested on baseless charges. Ending police intimidation is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, we determined that Yahoo lied about OccupyWallStreet.org being in spam filters. Ending corporate censorship is our one demand. You still with me, Ellen? Ms. McGregor? On September 21st, 2011, roughly 80% of Americans thought the country was on the wrong track. Ending the modern Gilded Age is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, roughly 15% of Americans approved of the job Congress was doing. Ending political corruption is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, roughly one-sixth of Americans did not have work. Ending joblessness is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, roughly 50 million Americans were without health insurance. Ending health profiteering is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, roughly one-sixth of America lived in poverty. Ending poverty is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, America had military bases in around 130 out of 165 countries. Ending American imperialism is our one demand. On September 21st, 2011, America was at war with the world. Ending war is our one demand. Does that help at all, Ms. McGregor? There's a little follow-up here addressed to the people of this country. You have fought all the wars. You have worked for all the bosses. You have wandered all over all the countries. Have you harvested the fruits of your labors, the price of your victories? Does the past comfort you? Does the present smile on you? Does the future promise you anything? Have you found a piece of land where you can live like a human being and die like a human being? On these questions, on this argument, and on this theme, the struggle for existence, the people will speak. Join us. We speak as one. All of our decisions, from our choice to march on Wall Street to our decision to continue occupying Liberty Square, were decided through a consensus-based process by the group, for the group. I like that. Just one demand. That's all they have. That's and it is this is probably a poor choice of words, but it makes me feel good to see the videos from Occupy Wall Street, the videos of the protesters, the people doing the organizing. And how decisions are made, in the first instance, is because the people doing the protesting are young. These are young people. Thank you. Bless you. Set the example, as young people always have, where it concerns refusing to have their minds occupied. It's one thing to have your country occupied or your political process occupied. It's something else again to refuse to have your mind occupied. And to see the videos is inspiring to me and makes me anticipate October 6th in Washington, D.C. Also, I forgot what I was going to say. Damn. I guess just commenting on the fact that these are young people who are leading what I think a lot of us hope is the beginning of a movement to stop the machine. That's a good thing. That's a good thing because it is the younger generation that is going to be most seriously affected. The other thing I want to mention now, it comes back to me, was the fact that they're using consensus to make decisions. The last time I was involved in that was during the anti-nuke movement back in the early 80s, or late 70s, in South Carolina and Georgia. And I had not heard of that system of decision-making before, and it was a real eye-opener to go through that process. Consensus decision-making means that if there are 30 people and there are 30 different ideas on how to proceed, then all 30 ideas have to be incorporated into the final decision on some level. And I can remember sitting up until the wee hours of the morning regarding the process of anti-nuke demonstrations, and for the most part listening, although occasionally adding my two cents worth, but watching how the consensus process actually worked, and how when the consensus process is used to make decisions, then the decision is rock solid. It cannot be shaken. It cannot be. It's not top down or bottom up. It doesn't require a leadership class. All it requires is people to understand that in an action like what OccupyWallStreet.org is doing, in an action like that, the stronger the movement, the more actually gets done. And to build a strong movement, you use consensus decision making. That's really good news to me. Creepy. Until you stop and think that the prison industrial complex has got to be fed. I think I mentioned last night, I mentioned a lot of times, that we, this society, the United States, now has the highest number, raw number of people in prison, as well as the highest percentage of our population in prison. In the United States, I mean, it's not the Chi-Coms, it's not, Russia, I don't know why I picked those two examples, but, it's not Cuba. I don't know why I picked them, but it is the United States. And marijuana arrests now comprise more than one half, to be exact, 52% of all drug arrests in the United States, marijuana. In 2010, this is according to Normal, in 2010, police made 853,000 arrests for marijuana-related offenses. That's a weed. And aside from the fact that that weed is in at least south of the American border controlled by murderous gangs, it's still a weed. If you're going to smoke marijuana, smoke domestic. You know what I'm saying? This is according to the FBI's annual Uniform Crime Report released yesterday. The arrest total is among the highest ever reported by the agency, and it's nearly identical to the total number of cannabis-related arrests reported in 2009. Almost a million people. According to the report, an estimated 46% of all drug arrests are for offenses related to marijuana possession. Not sale, not production, possession. Deputy Director of Normal, Paul Amentano, said, quote, "Today, as in past years, the so-called drug war remains fueled by the arrests of minor marijuana possession offenders, a disproportionate percentage of whom are ethnic minorities." No, you're kidding. Amentano went on to say, "It makes no sense to continue to waste law enforcement time and taxpayer dollars to arrest and prosecute Americans for the use of a substance that poses far fewer health risks than alcohol or tobacco," end quote. Except for the fact, Mr. Amentano, that there is a huge industry in this country now, the prison industrial complex. And it relies, for the most part, on people of color because they're the ones that can least afford a good defense. They're the ones that get executed the most for capital offenses when they are convicted. They're the ones that are least able to get an attorney who can have a charge of marijuana possession thrown out rather than wind up with a 10-year sentence someplace. Of those charged with marijuana law violations, 88%, 750,591, 88% were arrests for marijuana offenses involving possession only. The remaining 12% were charged with sale or manufacture. That's a category that includes virtually all cultivation offenses. By region, in case you're keeping track of this, by region, the percentage of marijuana arrests was highest in the Midwest and southern regions of the United States and lowest in the West, where pot prosecutions comprised only 39% of total drug arrests. That's interesting, isn't it? Especially if you live in Humboldt County, I would imagine you find that statistic kind of interesting. But it's because in certain parts of the country, people are starting to understand that marijuana, well, it's no longer a weed. I mean, obviously, it's not a weed now. It's been highly cultivated. It's been hybridized to the point where marijuana that is smoked today is probably, I mean, pick a number, I have no idea, but 50, 70, 80, 100 times more potent than marijuana smoked 40 years ago. And by contrast, the percentage of arrests for heroin and cocaine was lowest in the Midwest and highest in the Northeast. Well, that makes sense. And overall, law enforcement agents nationwide arrested 1,638,846 people last year for drug abuse violations, surpassing arrests for all other crimes recorded. And since 2000, this is the statistic that is shocking. Since 2000, the year 2000, law enforcement has reported making an estimated 7.9 million arrests for marijuana violations. Eight million arrests for marijuana. I don't know. That's an issue that we don't even talk about on this program anymore, do we, Kathy? We just don't. I can't believe when I saw that statistic today, it's just shocking, stunning, unbelievable. Marijuana possession. The execution of Troy Davis took place last night after U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas led the High Court in rejecting the plea that the killing be blocked. There were no dissents from the other justices on the current court, and the important word there is current. Former Justice John Paul Stevens, who left the court last year, has argued in recent statements and interviews that the death penalty is unconstitutional. Justice Stevens said, quote, "The patterns of discrimination where it concerns who's executed, the race of people executed in this country, quote, provides a haunting reminder of once prevalent Southern lynchings," end quote. We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy.
7 past the hour. I want to revisit what we talked about during the first hour about the execution of Troy Davis. I'm not sure how many people understand what the execution process consists of, where it concerns lethal injection. And also, specifically, what happened to Troy Davis with that roughly 4 hour delay. Troy Davis remained strapped to the gurney from his original execution time of 7 o'clock last evening up until about 10:45 when for some reason it took the Supreme Court 3 hours to simply say no. He remained strapped to the gurney. And then this concoction of drugs was administered. But to lay there for 3.5 hours, I don't know. Do you think that's the way we ought to be doing it? It's a 3-drug cocktail, as you probably know. The first one is sedation. A sedative drug that renders the person to be executed unconscious. And then the second injection paralyzes all the body's muscles, and which causes suffocation. And then the final injection, or the final drug, brings on a massive heart attack. But between 7 o'clock and 10:20, when the Supreme Court finally decided to answer the request by his attorneys, it's my understanding that Troy Davis remained strapped to the gurney laying there. The slogan, "The whole world is watching," an awful lot of people were watching last night around the world at yet one more act of barbarism in this country by a country that has a reputation now for, you know, some enormous acts of charity and kindness that seem to somehow slip through the cracks when you get right down to it, but whose main policies are, foreign policies are, warmongering, barbaric, no mercy, and the continuation of the death penalty when most, let's call them civilized countries, have decided against executions. And the problem here, a large number of states in the United States now have sentencing guidelines that includes life without parole for a particularly violent crime. And again, I do understand to the extent that I can. I can't go all the way, neither can you, unless you have experienced what the McPhail family, that's the name of the victim in the case at hand here, what the McPhail family experienced. Their son, brother, husband was shot dead trying to intervene in an act against his, if I remember correctly, against a homeless man on the streets of Savannah in 1989. So the horror of having a family member shot dead, and then as the mother of Officer McPhail said several times, this family was tired of waiting for what they call justice, and that is the execution of the person that was convicted. The problem with the conviction of Troy Davis, though, was very simply a matter of, I think, a matter of logic. Can you draw a logical conclusion that Troy Davis was guilty after, first of all, the only forensic evidence, I believe that's quite the right term, the only prosecutorial evidence was that the eyewitnesses who blamed him. There was no other, who identified him. There was no other evidence. There was no, obviously, or I guess obviously, no DNA evidence. The weapon, after all these years, was never found. There was no ballistic evidence linking Troy Davis to firing a gun. You know, some of the stuff that people see on television programs, some of it is correct. If you fire a handgun, there will be evidence on your hands that you fired a gun. None of that applied to Troy Davis, who I believe was 21. He was very young at the time, maybe, I guess a little bit older than that. And I don't know how old the officer was. I'm not trying to not focus on the victim who was shot dead in the street. But to not focus on Troy Davis and the case simply because he was convicted. But again, the evidence that convicted him was eyewitness reporting. And of the nine people who identified him as the killer, seven recanted after saying that they were threatened, they were forced, they were coerced into providing that kind of testimony. If you understand and follow convictions, you know, Kathy and I spent 3 years in Chicago, and there was instance after instance of the Chicago police providing false testimony to convict people. People who eventually, after spending years in prison, some of it on death row, were finally freed. There is a high-ranking police officer now serving time in prison in Illinois for torture. Torturing suspects in order to get confessions. This kind of stuff does happen. I know a lot of people, especially teabaggers and Christians, they like to turn their head away and say, oh, no, that doesn't happen. It's all done by the book. They arrest somebody. There's a questioning and investigation. Sometimes the perp breaks down and confesses and calls for his mommy. Sometimes he doesn't. But there is a nice investigation. All sorts of evidence is provided. The evidence presented to the jury. The jury deliberates. A conviction is returned. Or a guilty verdict is returned, the judge does the sentencing, and all is well and good in the House of Justice. That is a fiction. That is not how it works. I don't know how it works in other judicial systems, but in the system of the United States of America, that is not how it works. And possibly never has been. People who believe that have watched too many movies on Turner Classic Movies or too many old episodes of Perry Mason. That's not how it works. Troy Davis was not provided with legal representation during the state appeals process. Every time he turned around, he was denied access to the courts that was necessary. Now, a lot of people say, well, Malloy, there were all these appeals. There were two appeals to the Supreme Court based on legalese, based on, in one instance, I think, Troy Davis's attorney said, look, there is new evidence that will show his innocence. And the Supreme Court allowed a certain amount of time to present the evidence. And when the evidence couldn't be put together in quick enough time, the window closed. I don't know if people are aware that, what was the act that was passed during the bad old days of the Bush crime family, the Death Penalty Reform Act, or what was it called? I'll have to look it up here. But that act, an act of Congress, restricts the amount of time, the legal procedures that a defendant, a convicted defendant, can have in order to prove his innocence.
Can't believe the big screen. There's no justice in the hall. We're all criminals waiting to be called. They say don't step off the sidewalk and don't cross
60,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. The Oklahoma City bombing resulted in, among other things, the introduction of something called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. That bill was introduced by former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole. It was passed with broad bipartisan support by Congress and in the House of Representatives following the Oklahoma City bombing. It was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. And the act disturbs, if that's the right word, the law of habeas corpus in the United States, the law that says that you can file a petition on behalf of a prisoner that demands to show that why the state has an interest in convicting him, and whether or not violations have occurred regarding the U.S. Constitution. Now, what this death penalty, what's it called, Effective Death Penalty, Anti-Terrorism, and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, it limited the process, and it limited the circumstances in which a petition of habeas corpus could be filed on behalf of a prisoner who's been convicted and sentenced to death. And the idea was to speed up the death penalty process, that when someone is convicted, the assumption is made that that person was convicted fairly, justly, with proper amount of evidence. Everything is fine. Now let's get on with the business of execution. There have been many attempts by Republicans, by conservatives, by people who hate this country. Well, Republicans and conservatives who hate our system, all of our systems. Many attempts made to condense the appeals process down to the point where someone convicted of a capital crime essentially is left with no avenue to resist, to appeal. And part of this, of course, is based on biblical crap. You know, that a jury, and beyond that, that a jury of one's peers cannot be fooled if the prosecution presents evidence. Now, if it is discovered later that the evidence was tainted, that the eyewitnesses were coerced or forced to make testimony and have since recanted their testimony, if it's found out that investigators planted evidence, that investigators lied in the process of the trial, if all of that comes out subsequent to the person being convicted, then the person who has been convicted and is facing a death sentence has a certain amount of time to get all that on the record. Now, the prisoner has to do that, of course, from the confines of a prison, a state prison at that point, where his movements are strictly controlled, where his access to court records or a legal library are strictly controlled. So here's a person on death row who knows he's innocent. And, first of all, is in shock that he was convicted to begin with. I'm talking about the innocent people on death row, the innocent people in jail, and they are legion. If you don't understand that, then you have been totally brainwashed into believing that every conviction is a result of a clear legal process where evidence is presented, the system works, and only the guilty are in prison. Do you really believe that? Does anyone in this country, is there anyone in this country who is so naive, so ignorant as to believe that only the guilty are in prison for prison terms or awaiting execution on death row? Do you really believe that? Does anyone believe that? We have an adversarial system of justice in this country that demands that it's like a sports contest, two football teams. There are rules. There are penalties. Out of bounds, 15 yards, offsides, unnecessary roughness. You don't believe, I hope you don't, that everybody in prison, everyone on death row, how many people on death row? Over 3,000 awaiting execution. Do you honestly believe that all 3,000 or whatever the number is of those people are actually guilty of having committed capital murder? I know a lot of people do. And usually they are very religious. You know, oh, well, God makes sure that justice prevails. Oh, Jesus. Ah. But the system now has been twisted and skewed to the point where someone convicted of a capital crime, even not a capital crime, but let's stick with that because we're talking about the Troy Davis case. Even someone convicted of a capital crime has slight chance, knowing that he's innocent, in proving it. Because once a conviction occurs, then the burden of proof rests on a prisoner, someone on death row. The hour. I think anyone who is aware of the barbarism that is committed in our names in this country, locally, or I mean domestically, and where it concerns our relations with other countries, had to be concerned with the one-line response from the U.S. Supreme Court. No explanation, no rationale, just turning down 3 hours after a request was submitted, turning down of the request for a Supreme Court review, another Supreme Court review of the conviction of Troy Davis. And the offhand way, don't forget it was Antonin Scalia and his good friend, Clarence Thomas, who worked together to provide the statement that Antonin Scalia made, I don't know, was it several months ago? Was it this year, last year? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. But it was Scalia who said there is no constitutional protection against the execution of an innocent man. I'm paraphrasing, but that's exactly what he meant. There is no way to use the Constitution to stop the execution of an innocent person. You can approach the Supreme Court on the basis of violations, perhaps, of a constitutional protection, but the execution of an innocent person doesn't fall into that area, area of judicial review, which I thought at the time, well, isn't that madness? I mean, if you are basing your claim of an appeal on the fact that the person convicted of the crime did not commit the crime, there's nothing in the Constitution that will offer even temporary, as habeas corpus does, temporary, let's call it protection, until the case can be heard? The answer is no. No. And I think it was the flip kind of arrogant attitude on the part of Fat Tony Scalia when that statement was made. Like, oh, well, you know, if somebody is innocent and they've been convicted, there's no provision of the Constitution that guarantees them review based on their innocence. Kill them. So the Supreme Court last night, they, after leaving the situation with Troy Davis, strapped to a gurney for 3 hours, unless that reporting is absolutely incorrect, and I don't believe it to be. Leaving him strapped to the gurney for 3 hours, the high court finally finally made their ruling or their statement, a one-line denial without explanation, without dissent. All nine justices. Now, granted, the Supreme Court is not in session. I don't know how they, I think the petition or the request was handed to, oh my God, Clarence Thomas? And then it would be up to Thomas or his clerks to notify the other justices to get a decision. I think, I don't know. And if that's not how it worked, you don't have to send me an explanation and tell me how it did work. Because we're left with the bottom line. And that is that Troy Davis was executed last night when there was, for most people who can still use their brain, reasonable doubt as to his conviction. That's just about all you need to know. And no way to investigate the reasonable doubt. The machinery, the death machinery in this country, once it starts, it's almost impossible to stop it. Barry Scheck with the Innocence Project, whose organization has freed scores of people from death row, not on technicalities, but due to the fact that they are, in fact, innocent. Barry Scheck will tell you that once the death machinery begins to roll, your chances of extricating yourself from that machinery is almost impossible. But that's just an extension of so much else that we do in this country. Isn't it? I mean, we launched drone attacks against people. We have murder squads that go into other countries to execute people. We kill our own under false pretenses. 5,000 American young men and women who have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq based on the lies of the Bush crime family. And now every one of the sons of bitches that perpetrated those lies are jiggling around the country trying to sell their books and going to football games and talking sports and ooh this and ooh that. And in the meantime, the pile of corpses continues to get bigger and bigger. And I mentioned this last night when it comes down to appeals for one person who is about to be killed. To the power that is in this country, that's almost laughable. What? What? The dumb bastards are protesting one death? Oh, my God. We do 100 times that before breakfast in the morning. It's getting scary. I mean, it really is. But we're all asleep, and we're all put to sleep by a non-existent news media and entertainment a business whose sole function is to keep people anesthetized. I don't know. So while the appeals for Troy Davis worked their hopeless ways through the system, large numbers of people continue to be killed in our wars. While yesterday morning Obama is standing in front of the United Nations trying to convince people that we wage wars on behalf of peace. We torture people to death. How many people have we tortured to death? The New York Times several years back reported, I think, on 2 at Bagram Air Base torture facility run by the United States and our allies at the time in Afghanistan. People beaten to death, tortured to death. I mean, damn. So, when it was all over last night and it was time for me to retire to my bed, no one was going to slide lethal drugs into my veins the way they did to Troy Davis, so I could lament Troy Davis's execution I could be all radio talk show host and talk about the shame of it all like I'm doing now. Could talk about all the injustice perpetrated against people in this country. We now have more of our citizens locked up than any other country on earth, both as a raw number and as a percentage of population. Think about that. More people as a percentage of our population than the billion in China, the billion in India. Yeah, that's us. More numerically than China, more numerically than India. So, yeah, you know, lament all that and talk about it, as we do on this program almost every night, about the crimes that are committed. And yet there's, you know, there's no reaction. But the truth is, when I'm all done with my little lamentations and my, oh, isn't it awful kinds of statements about Troy Davis last night and tonight, I can go to bed. You know, I turn off the microphone, turn off the lights, close the door of the studio, go upstairs, have a cup of tea, and then go to bed. And of course, the people who are objects of this country's violence, whether it is in our prisons or in our war machine, they don't go to bed. They watch their children being blown to pieces, or their parents being blown to pieces, or they themselves cease to exist. How do we do this? How does this go on 24/7? And we are so busy trying to figure out whether or not Chaz Bono should really be on Dancing with the Stars or not, or we're trying to figure out, the latest terrible tragedy of one of the husbands on Housewives of this city or that city, Real Housewives, whatever the hell it's called. Can you believe this? Can you believe this? Or some freak name, what's her name, Snooky or Schnooky or Schmucky or whatever, on some program about people on the New Jersey Shore. That's what the focus is. This is astonishing. I mean, it really is. It would be laughable, except what we're watching are the death throes. I mean, the death rattle of even an attempt at self-government in this country, of democratic principles, of trying to run a coherent, respectful, compassionate society. It's just swirling around the drain and heading for the sewer.
I learned on TV. The man on the screen tells me who is our enemy. They say that we are free and we must fight to be number one. So when the army calls, I'll grab my TV, my car, and my gun. And the TV God watches over me.
It should be me.
Ten before the hour. So, you know, I can go up to bed when a night like last night is over and, or a night like tonight, go to sleep. But last night was a little bit difficult because I kept thinking about this case and what it must be like when, what it must be like if a person understands that they are innocent of what they've been convicted of and that they are about to die at the hands of the state. Even though they understand that they are not guilty, that they simply are not. How one deals with that is beyond me. Yesterday, Obama Press Secretary Jay Carney said that the president would not weigh in on Davis's case because it was a state prosecution. If that is not the most disingenuous statement I've ever heard, the federal government weighs in on state prosecutions every day. And the avenue to weigh in on a state prosecution where it concerned Troy Davis's impending execution, the opportunity was a mile wide, a civil rights violation. That's all it would have taken. The Justice Department, Barack Obama's Justice Department, to say, wait a second, we think that this person's civil rights have been violated, and petition based on that for a stay of execution until that could be investigated. No, the Obama administration is pro-death in the same way that the George W. Bush administration was pro-death, in the same way that the Bill Clinton administration was pro-death. And keep working your way back. The only people who identify themselves correctly as pro-life are the people who say they are pro-life for little bitty zygotes inside a woman's womb. Once that zygote becomes a breathing human being and is born, they're no longer pro-life. This is madness. God damn it. This is insanity. Is there any doubt that we live in a country that has gone slowly insane? I mean, do you not get that? I do. And sometimes I think, no, can't be. Not me, my country, my society. No, can't be. I don't know. I don't know. Had Troy Davis had an expensive lawyer, if Troy Davis had been white, I don't think he would have been killed by the state of Georgia last night. I don't think he would have. Do you? You know, if he would have had lots of money, white people with lots of money in our system don't get executed. It doesn't make any difference how bad the crime is. For the most part, they don't even get convicted. But my God. And Davis was told he would be killed after he was told he would not be killed. And then he was told he would be killed and then not be killed and then would be killed and then not be killed. And then last night he was told, okay, you get a reprieve. But not so much as to remove the straps from his ankles and wrists and let him up off the gurney. No, just lay there, boy. We'll know in a minute. And 3 hours later, in a one-sentence rejection of a last-minute appeal, the Supreme Court, with no explanation, no nothing, just, no, go ahead, kill him. So kill him, the state of Georgia did. I don't know. You try, some of us try, I try, not to think about these things. Whether it is blowing up innocent civilians or invading countries for no reason, occupying countries, killing people at roadside security checks, executing people in prisons in the United States. How much of that can you think about and retain your own sanity? How much? So I think a lot of Americans do that. Oh, I don't want to think about that. I want to know about Chaz Bono on Dancing with the Stars. Oh, look, isn't he overweight? How did he get so overweight? What's up with that? You know, he used to be a girl. You know, that kind of, I guess people do it because it's just too much to expect one's conscious ability to contain all this. So you start rejecting things. You just, I don't know about that. I don't hear about it. Doesn't affect me. Well, it does affect you. It really does. It affects me. It does, whether I'm paying attention to it or not. And that's the ironic part. It doesn't make any difference if you're aware that your government, no matter who your government is, it doesn't make any difference if you're not aware of atrocities being committed by your government. Because as long as it's your government, it's being committed in your name. Period. There's no way to get around that. Troy Davis last night was executed by you. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that kept eating on me when I'm laying in bed trying to go to sleep. You know, oh, Mikey can't get comfortable on his pillow? Mm, damn. Why not, Mike? Well, you know, I executed Troy. No, you didn't, for God's sake. Well, I could have done something. I should have done something. Maybe not in this particular case, but maybe just in trying to get the murder machine, the death machine in this country to stop operating. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.